I may not go home. They don't treat me this way at home. At home, they know me. For real. My name is Keith, and I am an alcoholic. I'm just so grateful to be here. I want to thank you so much. This is the first time I've been in the state of Maine, and it's absolutely magnificent. I can't tell you how, well, you know how lucky you are to live here, but it's just an exquisite state, and I congratulate you. I know you had very little to do with it, but anybody jumps up and takes credit, we'll talk to their sponsor, but it's just a magnificent place, and it's one of the places I've always wanted to come, and by the grace of God, I've made it here. And I'm just walking around outside saying a prayer or two, and it occurred to me that a little over 19 years ago, I was in a dive in a basement of a house on the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. So dark in there, even mold wouldn't grow. And all I wanted to do was die. And the thing that amazes me about being an alcoholic is that all of this was there then, but I wasn't. And then I didn't have the eyes to see or the ears to hear what was going on in the world. Then I would have told you a lot of things that just plain weren't true. I wasn't lying. They just weren't true. And then I found you, and then all that became true. I want to thank you for having me. I want to thank you for calling me up and asking me. Paul and Bill and John picked me up and drove me up here and told me it's just around the corner. I want to thank Ricky and Mary and Mary and the old timers. I've really gotten so much already. I just love so much of what Ricky said last night. And I especially liked that part where she said that her sponsor told her to laugh at her till she could laugh at herself. And I sponsor a guy who's sober about a year and having a rather difficult time. And we drive together to our home group. I'm a member of the new group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It meets Monday night in Fayetteville. And if you're ever going down 95, please stop and call. I'd be glad to come and pick you up. That's one of the things I get to do. I'm listed at Intergroup to go pick people up who are visitors, and I love to do that. But John and I ride over to the meeting together, and you know every Monday it's a crisis, and we both live. I mean, how bad can it be? We both live on a golf course, you know. And about the time we're driving out the gate, John's laughing at me, and you know he's beginning to laugh at himself. And I thank you so much, Ricky, because that describes perfectly what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I laughed at others, and one day I could laugh at myself. And I want to thank the old timers too for their message today. It's just I'll share with you maybe later the real truth about old timers. I won't do it now, but they're not everything they're cracked up to be. I can tell you that. Well, I might as well share it now, huh? You know what they'll do is they'll tell you things that just aren't true. They'll say things like, you know, we come to AA because we need to be here. You know, that's just a lie. They don't need to be here. The only reason they come to AA is because the only enjoyment they get out of life anymore is laughing at people like you and me. And if you don't think that's true, you don't think that's true, go out and find one of them and tell them a problem. You know? You've already done that, haven't you? Huh? First thing they do is go, oh, you know, they really are. And if you really want to get it, if you really want to make their day, go out and talk about a sex problem. They love it. Now, none of them are having sex anymore. You know. And they don't want you and me to have any either. I was newly sober, and I had a small problem. It's something a lot of men have had. Ozempic, which will just put a real crimp in your sex life. And I couldn't stand it anymore. I didn't want to talk to my sponsor about it because I figured he'd fire me. I mean, who'd want to sponsor somebody who was impotent? I mean, word might get around AA, and then it. So I made a mistake of telling an old timer, and it's the best time he had that month. And so he said to me, he laughed, you know, of course, and laughed. And finally, he said, don't worry. He said, a lot of us have had that problem. He said, it'll get better. I said, well, when? I thought it was important. And he said, a couple years. And they're vicious, too, because... Because right after that, he said, what, you got a full social calendar? So he gave me a great gift that night. It was an accident. He didn't mean to do it. But he told me, he said, you got a lot of problems, don't you? I said, yeah, I sure do. And he said, you want to do something about it? I said, I'll do anything. He said, all right, he said, I want you to borrow some lipstick from one of the girls in the program. He said, now, I don't want you to do anything else with the girls. He said, oh, that's right, you can. And, he said, I want you to borrow lipstick from one of the girls, and I want you to go home and write on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I said to him, I said, well, I can't do that. You see, my problem is I have a poor self-image, and I have to be affirmed. Don't ever say that to an old-timer. They haven't read any of those books. He said, look, borrow. I said, all right. So I didn't want to owe anything to anybody, especially a woman. So I went and bought a tube of lipstick, and I went home to this dive I was still living in, and I wrote on a mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I was disgusted, and I threw the lipstick in the wastebasket. And I guess I was sober about 60 days. Remember 60 days? Ooh, geez. And I went to bed, and it's a normal night. As soon as I lay down, my mind woke up for the first time. And it knew it was late, you know. And it took off, you know. And it was talking to me faster than I could hear. And it was saying, you're never going to make it. You'll be alone the rest of your life. What difference does it make? You're impotent. And my mind was just going and going and going. And I'd drift off to sleep, and then the leg cramps. Remember the leg cramps? I'd wake up in the middle of the night, and I'd be sweating and everything, and then I'd go back to sleep. And then at about 6:45, I'd fall sound asleep. And at 7 o'clock, the alarm would go off. All 5 alarms would go off. And I'd somehow wake up, and depression was waiting there by my bed, and it would jump on me, And I'd go out in the kitchen, I'd start to make coffee, and I'd be saying things like, you're going to go to work today, and they're going to find out you don't know how to do your job, and you're going to get fired, and what difference does it make? I'll be alone the rest of my life. I was good, the normal morning, remember those? I was ready to cry, and I went in the bathroom, and on the mirror it said, Keith, you were wrong. I said, well, thank God, because if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble. So the great gift in Alcoholics Anonymous is being wrong. Just think if we'd have been right. Wouldn't that be awful if we'd have been right? God, it'd been terrible. And at any rate, I'm... you probably tell I don't have a Southern accent. I made a U, but I don't to people in the South, and I'm working on it. If I have my way, I'll have one before it's all over. I love living where I live, and I told my kids, if they ever find me living anyplace else, get me to detox. But I was born in Ohio, and I'm on the Ohio River in a small town south of Pittsburgh, a place called Martin's Ferry. If you haven't been there, I wouldn't bother. I think it's been canceled. But I had 10 brothers and sisters. I'm Irish. I won't tell you what church I went to. I'm going to make you guess. I give you a hint. It has something to do with bingo, but I'm not telling you anymore. And I don't know if I was born in a dysfunctional family or not. At one time I thought so, but of course I've been wrong. So it's hard to know. But what I do know is I had a mother and a father who loved me very much. And we were talking about it earlier. I have brothers and sisters who didn't hear what I heard. And they didn't view things the way I viewed things. And I don't understand that because I'm sure I was there. But they came away with a lot of different conclusions than I had. We were poor, I mean, financially or monetarily poor, but I think we were wealthy in many other ways. I guess I had a mother and father who loved me. We didn't have a TV or anything. I mean, they had been invented, but we didn't own one. So we had to do dumb stuff, like we used to act out plays in the living room. And we had a reading hour. We had to read. And we couldn't read schoolwork. You had to read something just for the enjoyment of reading or to learn something. And then we had our prayer time. And as a family, we prayed together. And my father was a machinist and a great baseball player. And he taught my brother Denny and I to play baseball. And we'd go down in the basement in the wintertime, and he built these batting tees, and we'd practice all winter, take ground balls off the back wall. And you know, my father would spend as much time with me as I let him. So you see, I wasn't very poor. I was extremely wealthy. But none of it mattered. And I think it didn't matter because I had this incredible reservoir of fear. I don't know where it came from. It was just there. And I kept everything a secret. Even as a very, very small kid, I kept everything a secret. I was talking to a friend of mine today. We were talking about the thing that lived under the bed. Remember, you ever have any of those things? I don't know if they have them in Maine. We bred them in Ohio, and you know, at night you could lay there and the lights were out, and you press your little ear against the mattress, and you'd be down there moving around, you know. And I knew what it was there for. Nobody ever told me, but there's just some things you intuitively know. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed. Now it's history, you know, and I knew that, And so I'd sort of try to get in the middle of the bed because I discovered one morning that it could reach up over the side of the bed because there were marks in my sheets. And so I'd sort of lay in the middle of the bed and concentrate on being skinny. And I don't know where I came up with these ideas. They were mine, I guess, and I guess it's an old idea. I don't know. It wasn't very old at the time, but that's the way it was. And so that's perfect. I found that that's a perfect setup for alcoholism. I was frightened, and I felt very alone, even though I was surrounded by people who loved me. And I had priests and nuns and coaches and a lot of people who loved me. But what I had was an illness that didn't permit me to experience love. And I think that's what alcoholism is to me. It's that illness that won't permit me to see the incredible amount of caring that goes on around me. And other people see it. And, you know, I'd like to talk about my first drinking experience. I think it's important to. Very few people who don't have a first drinking experience make it to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I think that first drinking experience is important. And it took place when I was 5 years old. And I have a brother named Denny who's 4 years old. Old dumb Denny. And my father was watching us. I don't know. My mother was out, is it the bingo or having a baby or something, and my father was watching us, and we were sitting around the kitchen table playing games, and there was rarely alcohol in our house. My parents had parents who had drinking problems, so there was rarely alcohol around our house, but there were some beers in the refrigerator, and I guess my father thought it might be sort of funny, so he got three beers. He got one for me, and one for him, and one for dumb Denny, and he gave us those little jelly glasses. You might remember them. They had little cartoon characters on them, remember? Yeah. Mine had Superman on it. I don't know if that's significant, but the psychologist probably thinks so. But I remember that day, or that evening, very, very clearly. And I drank that beer. I drank the whole thing, and nothing happened. It was an amazing thing. Nothing happened. But Denny, I looked over, and old Denny was sliding out of the chair, you know? And he was rolling around under the table, and he was singing "Mary Had a Little Lamb" and other drinking songs. And my father kind of panicked, you know, so he wrestled little old Denny to the ground, and he got his clothes off, and he put his jammies on, you know, the kind of the feet and the trap door and everything. And he had him he took him up, put him in bed, and he said to me, get ready for bed, son. I said, okay, Dad. And I got ready and went to bed. And old Den's singing and carrying on and laughing and having a great time. And my father said, look, don't say anything about this to your mom, and I'll take you to movies. I thought, well, that's a good deal. Best nobody was negotiating with me when I was five. And so I said, fine, Dad, that's fine. But Denny wasn't hearing it. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. Old Denny stood up in his little crib, and he urinated on the floor. I remember watching this. I remember I was thinking, you know, here's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And you know, the strangest thing happened. Old Denny just never made it. You know, he's one of those guys with a lot of potential and just never made it. He grew up, and we're kind of ashamed of this, actually. He did strange things. For example, Denny grew up and went to one college. And he had one major. And he graduated in 4 years, if you can imagine. Went to one graduate school. Graduated on time, had a 4.0. Right? He had like six job offers, and he looked around and he picked one. You know? Now he's a vice president in a large international corporation. You know, and the strangest thing of all, he married one woman. Now you figure, here's a kid who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old. And just let it slip away. And, you know, I had to work at this thing. I was 23 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor. I recently up visiting Dan. We play in, he lives in New Jersey now. I don't hold it against him, but he bonks to a nice club up there, and every year I go up and play as member guest in June, and every year he comes down and plays our member guest golf tournament in October. And I was just up there with him, and he's still a strange guy. I mean, you know, he's just strange. I mean, does weird stuff. We'll go out to dinner or something like that, and he always shudders when people ask me questions. But like the waitress will come along and say something, would you like a drink? You know? And I'll say something like, yeah, bring me a case of scotch and a fire axe. And, and you know, he gets embarrassed and he says weird stuff like, he travels a lot, and I travel a lot, and sometimes we'll try to arrange to get together in different cities. And once we were in Washington, D.C., and I met him for dinner, and the guy came around and asked the question, would you care for a drink? And I just kept my mouth shut, give him a break. And I mean, I was really trying. And you know what he said? He said, no, thank you, not on an empty stomach. I said, that's the most disgusting thing I've ever heard in my life. I said, have a drink. Your stomach won't be empty anymore. There's a reasonably bright man, you know, reasonably well-educated, and he never figured any of this stuff out. And I graduated from high school, and it was one of the first miracles in my life, and I had an old idea that I was supposed to know what I was supposed to do. I don't know where I had that. Because it seemed to me you knew what you wanted to do. And I hadn't the foggiest notion of what I wanted to do. I didn't know what I was supposed to want to do. I mean, I just didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I couldn't imagine what I would possibly do with my life. And the one thing I did know was everybody went into the service, or all the men did. It wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of where and when. I mean, those were your choices. So I figured, well, I'll go to the service. And while I'm in the service, I'll figure this thing out. So I took one of my very first inventories. I went and I stood in front of the mirror and took my shirt off and I flexed my muscles and everything. I was 5 feet 1 inch tall and I weighed 113 pounds. I was a born killer. And so I went over and joined the Marine Corps. And I was still 17 years old. And So the recruiter had to come over and get my parents' signature, and I forgot to tell them. And I got home, and my mother was just in tears, and she was saying, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my father was saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." And the next morning, they took me over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and I got on a bus to go to Pittsburgh. And it was the second longest trip I'd ever taken in my life. It was 60 miles away. I went to Cleveland once, but the game was rained out. That was about 100 miles away. And I was a 17-year-old kid. I was absolutely terrified. And it was a very bad year. They took anybody who could breathe, and so they took me. And that afternoon, the thing happened to me that got me here. And that thing was, we had 8 hours between the time we were sworn in and we had to catch a train to go to boot camp. There were three guys from Pittsburgh, and, you know, they were big guys. You know, big guys are guys who have the big picture, you know, and they understand everything that's going on. They know all about girls and know all about politics, all about God, you know, and I never knew any of that stuff. So my job was sort of act like I knew. It was sort of like God got them all together one day, and he explained everything to them, you know, and I was in the bathroom. And I just never got the message. So my job was to act like I knew. And they said, "Look, we're going to go over and have a sandwich and a few beers. You want to come?" I said, "Well, yeah, that's just what I was thinking." So we went over to this bar in Pittsburgh. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in a bar in Pittsburgh. If you haven't, I wouldn't recommend it. But it was filled with real men, you know, the kind, you know, they had tattoos, they spit on the floor. I mean, they knew names of stuff I couldn't even imagine doing. And all of them had a real woman with them. See, real women hang around with real men. And guys like me got what was left. And I went in there, and I was just terrified. And a bartender came over, you know, and he was a real man. And he said, "What do you want?" And my first thought was, "Oh, no, a quiz." I sort of thought life was like a pop quiz. You know, when you least expected it, somebody was going to say, "Take out a blank sheet of paper, put your name in the upper left-hand corner." And I hadn't studied the night before. That's just the way I felt about life. So I watched what the other people did, and they ordered a beer, so did I. And they ordered another one, and I did too. And they ordered another one, and I did too. And then it happened. And you know what happened. If you're an alcoholic, you know exactly what happened. My life changed. My life changed in a very dramatic way. I stood up. I don't think I meant to stand up. I probably couldn't have kept from standing up. I just stood up. And I looked, and the floor was 6 feet, 4 inches below me. And I looked out, and my right shoulder was out to there, and my left shoulder was out to there, and the muscles were rippling through my body, you know. And that mind that had been filled with fear and terror and everything was like, boom, it was crystal clear for the first time in my life. And I remember saying, "Aha, of course, it's so simple. Why didn't I see it before? Of course." And for the first time in my life, I saw the big picture. And I remember looking up, and my heart broke. The place was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snivelling little men. Now, they all had women with them or looking at me with those hungry eyes. You know how they do it. And my life changed. I mean, it just changed dramatically. And I kind of went to take a step, and I stumbled, and one guy said, "What happened?" I said, "I don't know. I think I just tripped over an invisible line," because I really believe that that's the moment I became alcoholic. Now, I got a lot sicker than that, believe me, because I spent the next 12 years trying to duplicate that experience, trying to get back to that experience, and sometimes I come close, but I never, ever got back to Pittsburgh. That was the most magnificent moment of my life until I had been with you a while and met God. That was. And my sponsor and I have an ongoing debate. He'll say things like, "You know, there was a time you could have quit drinking." He said, "Maybe early on you could have quit drinking." I said, "Yeah, maybe I could have, but who would have wanted to? I mean, you know, that's the best I ever felt in my life. That's the first time life ever made sense to me. Who would have wanted to quit?" And I got good and drunk. It was wonderful. And I went from table to table that night, and I explained everything to everybody. And the feeling was that they were just so glad to see me. They've been looking for me all their lives. And that was the feeling. And when I left, I sort of had this sense that they were saying things like, "Please don't leave. We've just found you." And I said, "No, I have to go defend our country." And So I went and got on a train, and I woke up the next morning, and I was in a Pullman coach, and they'd put me in a Pullman coach, and I was laying on the floor of the Pullman coach, and someone had wet the floor I was lying on, and they also wet me, and I got up and changed my clothes, and the train was already in Washington, D.C., which was 300 miles from home, three times as far from home as I'd ever been. And I made a horrible discovery, and that was that my change was temporary. And I was 5 feet 1 inches tall and weighed 113 pounds again. And again, I was terrified. And these guys came and knocked on the door, and I opened the door, and they said, "Look, we're going to go over and have a beer. Would you like to come along?" And I figured, well, what do I know? I'm from out of town. And so I went with them, and the same thing happened. And that night, I fell off a train in a place called Yamasee, South Carolina. So somebody moved the bottom step. I never really understood what happened, but I fell across the next set of railroad tracks, and there was a very rude man there who came to greet us. And he was hurling obscenities at myself and the other young men who'd gone down there to die for our country. And I got up and I tried to explain to this cretin that he'd get a lot further if he treated us with a little dignity. He hadn't read that book either. They call him a drill instructor. And the only thing I learned from that experience was I could do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's the only thing I learned from that experience. So I was thrust into the Marine Corps, and I must say I loved the Marine Corps. I always used to say next to the nuns it was easy. And I loved it. I loved everything about it. And I went on, graduated from Paris Island. I won Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award, just all kinds of stuff. And I gained like 30 pounds or something, you know, that sort of thing that happens to people when they're put in an environment like that. And I just loved it. I really did. And I made up my mind I was going to stay for the rest of my life. And, of course, 4 years later, I got out because, you see, I was alcoholic. And I'd begun to do things in combat and places like that that just scared me to death. And things I couldn't talk to people about. So what I did was what I always did. I blamed them for what was going on with me. See, that became a very common practice of mine. Worked hard to get commissioned, and I was given an appointment to go to Quantico to go to Officers Candidate School. And at the last moment, I changed my mind because of some strange things that I had done, and I got out. And people said, "Well, why are you getting out?" And I said, "Just because of the Marine Corps." And I blamed the Marine Corps, and I got out, and I did the things all alcoholics do. I mean, you know, you're here and you're an alcoholic, you know what happened. I had a disease that guaranteed that I drank. That's it. And it also guaranteed I'd pay whatever price it took to drink. I'm always amazed that those people who do not have alcoholism don't understand that. And they say things like, "How could you? How could you do this? How could you do that?" Well, because that's what it cost. That's why, because I had to get back to Pittsburgh. Somehow I had to get back to Pittsburgh. They'd never been to Pittsburgh. They didn't know. And I had to get back there. And one day I went into the NCO club and I said, "Give me a scotch on the rocks." And I said, "How much is that?" And they said, "Well, it's 35 cents in your Marine Corps career." And I said, "Well, that sounds about right." So I paid it. And then one day I was at a liquor store. I guess I left work and went to a nice bar in Washington, D.C. and ordered a martini. Benny, the bartender, I said, "How much is that, Benny?" He said, "Well, it should be $1.25, and your wife and your children." And I thought, well, that's about right, so I paid. And then one day I was living in a dive in the basement. I was drinking in bootleg joints on 14th Street in Washington, D.C. And I got a bottle of wine or something, and I said, "How much is that?" The guy said, "Well, it's 69 cents in your life." And it didn't seem like too much. It seemed like the right price. And what people who aren't alcoholic don't understand about us, no matter how hard they try or how much they love us, is that we've got to pay whatever the cost. We've got to pay it to get back to Pittsburgh. And it's hard for people to understand. It really is. And it's very, very hard for them to understand. You know, I was a promising young researcher studying genetics and I was doing well, and I was publishing, and I published in ethics, and I was doing things, and people wondered why I stopped, why it didn't seem to matter anymore. Well, one day that's what it cost. And that to me is alcoholism. I think alcoholism is that disease that guarantees that I'll pay whatever I have to pay for the next drink. It also guarantees that I'll violate absolutely every principle I ever held. One of the neat things about being sober is I don't have to violate nearly as many principles as I did before. It's not because of me, it's because of you. One day, May the 13th, 1973, I had my then wife had asked me to leave. I had two lovely little children, Kelly and Kimberly. And they were 2 and 3, going on 3 and 4, and she asked me to leave, and I knew she was right. We'd had those horrible, horrible times, and I'd fall asleep with cigarettes and just all the things that happens with alcoholics. And she, of course, was about half crazy and living with me. And let me tell you what alcoholism was in our house, okay? I'd promise her I wouldn't drink anymore, you know? And we'd start over. Anybody here ever start over? And we'd take the children to grandmother's house, either to her mother's or to my mother's house. And we'd come back and we'd start over. And the way we'd start over is she would get some of those little negligees, you know, those little things that do things to us. And I'd make up my mind, I'd tell all the guys at the bar I wouldn't be back, that we were starting over. And they'd say, well, we're pulling for you. And we'd start over. And I'd get up and she'd give me breakfast in bed, you know, the way it always should have been. And I'd go off to work. And then I'd come home from work and she'd be waiting for me, you know, at the door with one of those little frilly things, did funny things to you, and it was wonderful, and starting over was the greatest thing in the world, and maybe that night I might take her to the theater. She loved the theater, so we'd go down to the Kennedy Center or something, and the next night I'd come home, and she'd be waiting for me, and she'd have tickets to the Orioles game, and we'd drive to Baltimore, go to the Orioles game. We'd come home, she'd put on one of those things. Wonderful. And I guess somewhere about 4 or 5 days into starting over, I was driving home one day, and it occurred to me I was very selfish that I hadn't let the guys at the bar know how well this thing was going. And I'd stop by to share with them, and they were happy for us. They figured we had the best marriage. And so they'd buy me a drink. And, you know, one thing leads to another. And I look, and all of a sudden it's 8 o'clock. Well, I know if you go home at 8 o'clock, it just causes trouble. So for her sake, I stayed till 2. Because I knew by then she'd be asleep and everything. And I was always thinking of her. And, you know, on the way home, though, I began to rethink my position. I said, you know, that little girl is just, she's crazy about you. And she's crazy about your body. And she went and bought those things. And she'll probably have one on. So, well, if she requests a favor, do it for her. And I decided I'd do that, and I came in, and she was up, but she didn't have one of those on. She had this thing on she wore that sort of started up here, you know, and it went clear to the floor and clear out to her wrists. It looked something like a buffalo robe. And basically, what it meant was not tonight. That's basically what it meant. And I began to demand my rights, and we got in this big argument, and I wouldn't hit her, but I'd tear the place up. I'd just run around. I'd throw things. I'd tear the place up, you know. Well, she was seeing a psychiatrist, which explained why I drank the way I drank. And she was taking some medicine and made her eyes look in different directions at the same time. And she grabbed her Jetta matching buffalo robe house coat. She grabbed it, put it on. She grabbed her purse and ran out. And I knew exactly what was going to happen. You know, we'd been down this road before. She was going to call this psychiatrist that she was having an affair with. And they wanted to get rid of me, see, and he'd tell her to call the police. So I went into action. I ran around. I straightened that place up. I vacuumed everything. I mean, it looked better than when I got home. And I put everything away, and I ran, and I took my clothes off, and I put on some pajamas I wore when the police came. I put those on, and I put a robe on, and I messed my hair up, you know, and the doorbell rang, and I went, I looked through the peephole, and it was my wife wrapped up in her buffalo robe and two county policemen. And I gathered myself together. You know, as only an alcoholic can do it. I pulled the door open, and I said, thank God you found her. Yeah. So the policeman said, can we come in? And there were two cops. One was about my age, you know, about, you know, mid to early 20s, and the other was an older guy, about 31. And so I said, please come in. I'm beside myself with worry. And You can't be too careful with the cops. They came in, they began looking around, and she had that, oh, I've been had again look on her face, you know. And but you can't be too careful. So I said to her, honey, did you call the police? Or did you call your doctor? And she said, yes, I did. I said, well, thank God. If you have to run out in the middle of the night, at least you called your doctor. You know? And she just started to cry, and she ran in the bedroom. And the older cop sort of reached over and hit me on the arm, and he said, you hang in there, son. I said, yes, sir. And, but, you know, the really sad thing about that whole deal was I went and I made myself another drink. That's a traumatic experience. And I got her a glass of wine, and I went in, and she was sitting on a bed. I never forget this. And she had big tears just dripping off her cheeks. And she said to me, can you ever forgive me for embarrassing you like that? Yeah. And I said to her, I said, honey, you don't mean to be having problems. And she said, I'm so glad. Please never leave me. Promise me you'll never give up on me. And I gave her wine, and I had my drink, and she took the buffalo robe on and off and put one of those other things on. And we were utterly convinced, my friends, that we were the luckiest couple in the neighborhood. We were utterly convinced that we were more in love than anybody else. And it was sheer and utter insanity. Sheer and utter insanity. The day came in a blackout when I did hit her, and I blacked her eye. She worked in an emergency room. And she and the other nurses would snicker and look with great condemnation at this woman who would come in with a black eye and lie about how it happened. And you know, I blacked her eye, and she went to work and asked what happened, and she told them the same thing that those patients who came to that emergency room told about their husbands or boyfriends. And she expected they would believe her. We don't think family members have problems with this disease, my goodness. You know, one day she said to me, 1972, she said, we can't live like this anymore. She said, one of us has to go. Either you go or the kids and I are going. And I knew she was right. And I packed a few things and I left. And I went, I believe I went to die. I really do believe that. And it was about 6 months later, May the 13th, 1973, and I was living in this dive. And I went in and I got up one morning, and I guess the price was my life. And I went into what served as a bathroom to take my life. I had a bunch of pills, and I worked in hospitals, as did my wife, and I had all these pills and things. And to this day, I can't tell you if I took them or not. I really can't tell you if I began to take them or not. I certainly got them ready to take. I don't know if I began to take them or not. What I do know is I said out loud, you're 29 years old, and at least it'll be over. And this voice outside of me, a woman's voice, said, when you're 29, it's not supposed to be over. It's supposed to be starting. And I was startled by this voice. It was like somebody was standing in that little bathroom with me. And I was shocked and startled. And I immediately remembered that my ex-wife, estranged wife, had given me a couple phone numbers. I knew there were two of them, and I rushed in, and I could only find one. And I ran over, and I called that phone number. And later, she was to tell me that she gave me a phone number to Alcoholics Anonymous, which I never knew existed. And she also gave me a phone number to a treatment center. And I could only find the one, so I called it, and it was the treatment center. And a woman answered the phone, and I said to her, if you can't help me, I think I'll have to die. And I think she could hear the panic in my voice and everything, and she said to me, could I have your number, please? I have another call, and I'll call you right back. And I now know that she wanted to get my number in case she couldn't help me so she could call the police, because I know how desperate I must have sounded. And she called back in just 30 seconds, and she said, how can I help you? And I said, I don't know what's the matter with me. And she said, are you drinking? I said, well, of course I'm drinking, but I don't know what's the matter with me. and she said, perhaps we can help you. And she invited me to come to them. And she said, it'll be about 4 weeks you'll be here. And she said, can you come in a few days? And I think it was like Wednesday or something. And I said I could, and she gave me directions. And I hung up the phone, and I sat down on the floor, and I just began to cry. And it occurred to me I hadn't cried in quite a while, I guess since my little Kimberly was born and nearly died. And I just cried and cried, and I looked up, and my heart just stopped because it was a bottle of scotch on a draining board, and it had one drink out of it. And God gave me, if you kind of knew, I would urge you to please, if you get a chance tonight, particularly in these wonderful surroundings, it might make sense to ask yourself, what is it that God's given me that's special? Because I'm convinced that when we come to this fellowship, there's something that God has, it's sort of a special gift, just sort of gift wrapped for us. And it might be a person, it might be an idea, it might be someone who's prayed for you, but it's something special that's going to make it for you in this fellowship in the beginning. And I'll tell you what my gift was. I knew, I had an idea, and I knew that if I took one drink of alcohol, I was going to die, and knowing that would never keep me from taking it. You see, up until this time, I did various things to scare myself into drinking less. When I was in the service, I would volunteer to go on cruises. Nobody wanted to go on cruises, and I'd go because when I was on cruises, I'd be away from booze, and I'd work out, and I'd do this, and I'd do that, and I'd get strong, and my mind would come back, and I'd get mentally sharp again and everything. When I worked in a hospital, they used to post the upcoming autopsies, and they would post, when the autopsy was and what person died of. And if you were interested in any of this stuff, you're sort of like coming attractions, you could go watch the autopsy. And sometimes they'd have somebody listed as chronic alcoholism, and I'd say, I want to watch that one. And I'd go and I'd watch as much as I could. I hated those things. I'd watch as much as I could, and I'd say, yeah, and I'd leave, and I'd go down to Chadwick's or Clyde's or someplace, and I'd say, Vinny, you'll never guess what I just saw. You better give me a double. And he said, you always get a double. I said, well, you better give me a triple. And then the other guys would ask me what I saw, and I'd explain to them about the liver and the brain and all that stuff, and they'd go, oh, geez, better give us a triple, too. And then we'd say, how can people do that to themselves? They obviously have no pride, and all that nonsense, So I knew I could never be scared into being sober. And I ran over and I grabbed that bottle and I was going to pour it out. And I knew I wouldn't. I knew that if I took one drink of alcohol, I'd die. And I knowing that would never keep me from taking it. And I threw the bottle in the sink and it broke. And if it bounced, I don't think I'd be here. You see, I am powerless over alcohol. And that's the gift that God gave me on May the 13th, 1973. From that day until this one, I have not had to take a drink. But what I must tell you is this. If I drink, I'll die, and knowing that will never keep me from taking a drink. So what I need is a miracle, and that's your job. See, that's where you come in. You've arranged a miracle that a day at a time keeps me from having to take that drink. I'll tell you how I picture it. Okay, this is how it works for me, and if this is helpful, please use it. If it isn't, throw it out, put it on the shelf or whatever. I kind of picture it this way. You see, there's a drink out ahead of me, and it's got my name on it. It says, Keith's Drink. And I don't know. It might be a martini or a glass of champagne or a bottle of scotch. I have no idea what it is, but it's out there. And it says, Keith's Drink. You see? Now, I haven't had a drink now for over 19 years. See? And I'm glad for that. And I celebrate my birthday, and, the guys I sponsor, and we have a silver dollar with 19 holes in it. Next May, by the grace of God, I'll give it to them, and they'll drill another hole and give it back to me. And so we have all these sort of nice things. And I have my friends gave me a thing that I wear around my neck sometimes. It has my sobriety date on it. And my lovely wife, Julia, who will cross-stitch anything, has cross-stitched that date on everything. I mean, we've got it hanging on the wall, got it on pillows. I mean, so that's an important date, okay? But that's not the drink that matters to me. You see, the drink that matters to me is the one I must take. I want you to hear this. You see, I'm an alcoholic, and what that means is I must drink unless there's a miracle. And that's where you come in. And you see, that drink's out ahead of me. And if you're new, it's right there. You remember that? 5 minutes away. Remember 5 minutes at a time? Remember that? I won't drink for 5 minutes, and I'm going to drink. I don't care what they say. All right? 5 minutes. I'm not going to drink. I don't care what they say. The liquor store is closed. It'll be open in the morning. I'll get it then. And then all of a sudden, it was a day away. And then, as I got involved in this program and I began to work the steps, and my sponsor dragged me around all these places and I met all these people, it got further and further away. And one day, I was comfortable. And you know what I said? I said, what I need is a little balance in my life. Balance is an excuse to not go to as many meetings as you used to and not take phone calls. So I went out seeking balance. And pretty soon I was irritable and discontent. And I'd go to meetings and I'd say, well, there's that jerk. He's going to say the same thing he always says. But that's the way it is when you have brain damage. I think I'll leave a little early because such and such is on and on and on and on. And by the grace of God, one day I realized what the problem was. I was catching up to that drink. And I'd gotten close to it again. And I went and I talked to people that I knew loved me. And I told them what I'd been doing and everything. And I threw myself back into the program. And what do you think happened? Drink moved further away from me. And that's the way it's going to be. And I don't know, I plan on living to be maybe 99 or 100 or something. I was going to really clean it up at 99 in case the nuns were right. And I was going to have one real good year. And then I'd die in maybe 6 months or 9 months, maybe a year later. Somebody would say, whose drink is that? They'd say, that's Keith's, but he died. See, my goal is to push that drink ahead of me till I die and never have to take it. And if I stay with you, I can do that. You know, I went off to this treatment center about 3 days later, and I heard things and I saw things, and I guess I convulsed. I don't know what all happened, but I know that one day I got in my car to drive out there, and I had no friends. I had them. I mean, a lot of people loved me, but I had no friends. I mean, I didn't believe there was anybody in my life who wanted to do anything for me, which is astounding to me now because at that moment there were many, many people who loved me. But, you know, this disease takes all that away, and I couldn't see it and I couldn't hear it. And I got in that car and tried to drive myself out. And I still had the horrors. I don't know if anybody here has had the horrors. But the horrors are, you know, that the panic would set in. And I'd begin to shake and I'd begin to cry. And I could only drive about a mile at a time. And I'd pull the car over and I got out of the car and I was shaking and crying. And I wet my pants and I was sick and all that stuff. And it took me about 5 hours to drive 30 miles to that treatment center. And when I got there, the bed was gone. I hear a lot of people stand up here and say bad things about treatment centers, and everybody's entitled to their opinion. I must tell you that if it weren't for this treatment center, I'm convinced I'd be dead. So, you know, a lot of people don't like them. And a good thing about AA is that so you can like or dislike whatever you want. It doesn't matter. If you don't drink, you'll probably stay sober. But I can't say bad things about them because it saved my life. And I got there and I said to him, I said, could I leave my car in your parking lot? And the lady said, well, yes, you can, but why? And I said, because if I go back to town, I'm going to die. And she somehow knew that was true. And they let me sleep on the sofa. And that night, somebody ran away. And I got his bed. And I sure as hell hope he's all right. But I needed that. And that night, the great miracle happened. That night, they loaded me on the bus and they took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that night, I met you for the very first time. And you've changed a lot in 19 years. Then you were all real old. You really were. You were real old. You were. And I had a greeter, much like you do, you know. And as a greeter was an old guy who stood at the door and shook my hand, you know. And the guy had two heads. I know he had two heads because wherever I looked, his face was right there. And he's one of these funny people, you know, look you in the eyes. You know the kind, you know. I was a shoe person. And he was an eye person, and keep looking in my eyes, and he shook my hand, and he shook it. It was very firm, and he shook it with both hands, and he said, I'm glad you're here. He said, you know, if you keep coming here, you never have to drink again. I thought, what a strange thing to say. And he took me over and set me next to this old woman who was about 10 days older than dirt. And she began to pat me, you know, I had 3 days. Remember, your skin's moving around, and this old woman's patting me. And about halfway through the meeting, she looked at me, and that old face exploded into a smile. And she said, you know, Sonny, you keep coming here, you never have to be alone again. And I began to cry again. I didn't understand this crying business. You see, I didn't know that what I'd been was alone. I didn't know that I could lay in bed next to the woman I was married to and feel like I was a stranger, that at any moment her husband was going to come home and catch us. And I could walk into the room and those two little girls that I adored. I had a lot of brothers growing up, and all I ever wanted as a father were daughters. That's all I ever wanted. And I had these two precious, precious little girls. And sometimes in the middle of the night, I'd get up and I'd wander. And I'd wander into their rooms. And sometimes I'd go over and just touch their head, stroke their little heads. And I loved them so much, and I knew that they must not be mine because nothing that good could have anything to do with me. And I didn't know that what that was being alone. I didn't understand that. When the second daughter, Kimberly, was born and they didn't think she'd live and she was in the neonatal nursery, and and our offices were across from there, and I'd sit in there at night with the light out, and I'd watch this little pound and a half angel fight for every breath. And I didn't know that. And her mother came in one night to baptize her because they didn't think she lived through the night. And her mother was like a zombie with a thousand-yard stare. And I wanted to run over and put my arms around her and say, "I'm here, and I'll carry half of it, and you can lean on me." But I was afraid. And I didn't know what that was being alone. That's what I was alone. And coming to you changed that. And you changed it so quickly. It took me a long time to get better. But you changed being alone so quickly. And you did it in such interesting and magnificent ways. You told me things, you know. Old timers. There's an old guy, he's dead now, his name is Buck Doyle. And old Buck used to, you always knew when you're no longer an old timer or a newcomer because you didn't have a bruise on your chest anymore. Because Buck would always poke in your chest when you're, and he'd go, and he'd, you know, poke you in the chest, you know. And one day, he wasn't poking me in his chest anymore, and I didn't think he liked me anymore. Buck was a wonderful guy. I really loved him so much. He probably helped more drunks than anybody I know. And he always had one living in his house, or his apartment. And he came, and he was a guy who laughed at himself. I was thinking about him when we were talking. He always laughed at himself. He came in, we used to have lunch pretty regularly. And he came in laughing, and he said, "You know, Keith, I'm never going to get any better." I said, "What do you mean, Buck?" He said, "I'm never going to get any better." He said, "You know, I was out running this morning." He said, "I ran 6 miles. He said, "That's a long way for a guy 62 years old. I said, "Yeah, it's a long way." He said, "You know, there's a fellow who lives below us in an apartment. He said, he's crippled. He said, he has braces. He has crutches. And he says, he struggles along." And I was coming in this morning after my run. He said, "Oh, Buck, you've been running?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, how far did you run?" He said, "I told him 7 miles. He said, "I'd run 6 miles, and I had to tell him 7 miles. It just came out of my mouth." He said, "Here's a guy, give anything, run 10 steps. And he said, "I'm never good enough." He said, "What I do and who I am is never enough." And he laughed. And he said, "Well, I got a long time to get better. Maybe one day I will be." And I remember thinking about that. I said, "Yeah, I do that. You know, I'm never adequate, so I have to add something to it." Now, you know, if you're around long enough, they start calling that lying. You know, I was one of these people who couldn't sleep, you know. And I enjoyed the old-timers up here today. God bless them. And I remember one gentleman was talking about the fact that meetings are a little bit different now. And I don't know whether they are or not. They probably are. But I seem to remember that we didn't talk about problems. I remember somebody say, we talk about principles, you know, how you deal with fear. But nobody asked about problems. But at the very end of the meeting, they'd say, "Is there anybody here have anything they need to say?" I'd put my hand up and I'd say, "Yes, Keith." I'd say, "I can't sleep." And, you know, they take turns because they all wanted to be in on this. And, it's your turn, Bill. Okay. Nobody ever died from not sleeping. As a head case, you know, I one night I screamed, "No, but people died from saying nobody ever died from not sleeping." I had it. And so I used to drive around all night sometimes. I'd just drive around, look at the monuments, read stuff, you know, and just drive around. And one night I drove down to Jefferson Memorial and laying in the grass. It was in August, so from May to early August. I'm laying in the grass. I'm looking at the stars and a miracle happened. I fell asleep. I woke up about an hour later. I said, "My God, of course. It's not that you can't sleep. You've been trying to sleep in the wrong place." So I went home and I got a sleeping bag and I came out. I rolled it out, you know. I lay down. I went right to sleep. And I guess about an hour later or something, somebody's kicking me. And I woke up and it was a cop, park policeman. He said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I'll tell you what I'm doing here." And I told him my story. And he said, "No kidding." He said, "You can't sleep?" And I said, "No, only here." He said, "Well, I'll tell you what." He said, "Anytime you need to sleep, you come down here." And so, you know, every once in a while, you know, after 3 or 4 days of not sleeping, you know how crazy you get. I get my sleeping bag and I go down to Jefferson Memorial and I'd lay it out, you know, I'd be laying there looking at the stars, you know. And I'd hear this voice, "Keith, is that you?" I said, "Yeah." And he'd say, "Would you like a cup of coffee?" I said, "No, I better get some sleep. I have to go to work." And he'd say, "Well, don't worry about," he said, "we'll keep an eye on you. We won't let anything happen to you." You know, I was wrong about the police. And I'd been wrong about everything. You see, and I think that's the great lesson of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been wrong. I've been wrong about everything. You know, I went to, again, a gentleman said today that you never used to hear 90 meetings in 90 days. And that was true. They just said, go to meetings. Are you having problems? Go to meetings. Oh, still having problems? Go to meetings. You know? And you know, when I was in that little treatment center, my roommate was the only guy in there younger than me. And he was 27 years old. And God, he was a big, good-looking guy. You know, the kind of guy you hate, fellas. And you know, he had a farm, big farms down on the Eastern Shore. And he had a Corvette out in the parking lot. And all the women loved him. And you know, the kind of guy. You know, they go for all that exterior stuff. And you know, I came back. After going to meetings about 2 weeks, I guess, I came back, and something happened at that meeting, and I can't remember what it was, but what I remember was I was absolutely overwhelmed by what you were. And I said to this guy, I said, "You know, I'm going to do whatever those people tell me to do." I said, "If they tell me to go sit in a tree, I'm going to go sit in a tree." I said, "I'm not going to ask them why. I'm going to try not even to think of why. I'm going to go sit in a tree." And he said to me, "My God, they brainwashed you." And I said, "God, I hope so. If anybody's brain needs washing, it's mine." And you know, he never got brainwashed by you people. And, you know, 1 year later, I was celebrating my first anniversary. In that first year of sobriety, I'd been absolutely mad. I mean, I couldn't leave that apartment. And 6 months later, I was studying in Paris, France. And I left there, and my sponsor just happened to come through Paris when I was there. And we spent some time together. And I went to Rome, and I lived in a monastery for a little while, just because I always wanted to. I mean, this stuff I always wanted to do. And I just went and did it. And I lived in a monastery, and I met all the drunks in Rome, and went to the embassy, and we had a wonderful time. And the year had been absolutely mad. You know what I mean? It's just been one of those mad and magnificent and crazy years. And I'm up there, and my sponsor, Dan, said, "Boy, Keith did everything wrong this year except two things. He didn't drink, and he went to 500 AA meetings." And he said he didn't do anything else right. And when the meeting was over, this fellow who had been my roommate was at the meeting. He was in the back, and he had a different kind of year. He didn't get brainwashed. What he did do was get drunk a few times. And the third time, he'd lost the farms and the Corvette and everything. And he had a patch on his eye because he was in a psychiatric ward and somebody gouged his eye out with an ice pick. And you know what he said to me? He came up to me and he said, "Congratulations." I said, "Well, thank you." He said, "I know you like this stuff." And I said, "I really do." And he said, "Don't you think you're overdoing it with the meetings?" And I didn't want to be cruel, and I didn't mean to be cruel, but I wanted him, I desperately wanted for him to understand what happened. And I said to him, I said, "You know, one of us got one eye and one of us got two eyes." And he said, "What's that got to do with anything?" And I realized that night, and I talked to my sponsor about it, because I felt guilty that I had been given a year of sobriety, and he didn't have it. And I felt bad about it, and my sponsor told me that night, he said, "You know, some people are blessed with sobriety, and some aren't." He said, "In the next life, we'll all be sober." And I said, "Well, why would God pick me to be sober in this life?" And he said, "I haven't the foggiest notion." He said, "You know," he said, "if I were picking people, I wouldn't pick you." He said, "But you know, then again, I never would have picked me either." And he said, "Maybe God wants us to do something with this gift of sobriety in this life." And it made perfect sense to me. It made perfect sense to me. You know, all the old ideas were just that. I'll give you an example of another old idea. I was afraid of heights. I really was. I was afraid of heights. And my thought was, if you're afraid of heights, you lack courage. And if you wanted courage, you had to go do something brave. So I was in the Marine Corps. I was afraid of heights. So I volunteered to go to mountain climbing school. So they sent me out to the Sierra Nevadas, and I'm rappelling from mountains in the middle of winter. You know, now I'm terrified, and I do it with my eyes closed and drunk. I mean, that's how I do it. But I think that's what you do about fear. Well, of course, I came away from that more afraid of heights than I'd ever been in my life. And I didn't understand, you see. I was wrong. And then I came to you, and I was in Paris, and my sponsor, Dan, came, and we took a train ride down to Chartres to see the cathedral. And we were walking across the town square, and he was all excited about seeing it again, and he's excited about showing it to me. And he said, there's a catwalk there. And he said, we can walk around that catwalk and look down into the church. And my heart just froze because I knew that meant heights. And I said, to myself, be brave. And I said, no. And I said, Dan, I'm afraid of heights. And Dan said, oh, you got the old I'm afraid of heights problem. He said, a lot of us have had that. He said, you don't need to go up there if you don't want to. He said, it doesn't matter. He said, well, you can go up as far as you want. He said, or I can hold your hand. Thought, what a novel idea. And he held my hand, and we went up, and I got clear to the top. And I didn't dance around or anything up there, but I got there. I said, isn't that nice? I'm going to go down now. You see, my idea was that I had to do it alone and that I had to be brave. And what I learned was what I had to do is put my hand out to another alcoholic. And then they would take my hand and they would walk me through whatever I was afraid of. So I've been wrong about everything. And that's the great blessing. And I finally went to that sponsor and told him I was impotent. And he hadn't been around too long, so he just smiled. And he said, you know, a lot of us have had that problem. He said, for a lot of us, it goes away. I said, well, when? And he said, well, let's look at it another way. I said, you know, Dan, that's one of those things that's either or, I think. I said, that's a real black and white thing. He said, no. He said, let's look at it another way. He said, you have a lot of problems, don't you? I said, I got thousands of problems. He said, every time somebody has a problem, you have it too. I said, that's an amazing thing. It's true, though. He said, now, of all the problems you have, which one's going to be more fun to work on than that one? And I said, you know, that's a good way of looking at that. So that's what sponsors do. You see, they put a smile on tragedy. And I've been wrong about everything. You know, I came here, I was just going to stay for a little while because I had things to do. And I want to stay for 60 or 70 years, or as long as you'll let me. And I know you've got to let me stay. You see, because the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. So you've got to let me stay. You've got to let me stay for me, and you've got to let me stay for you. You have to accept me the way I am, because you know that next year will be different. If I stay sober and work these steps, next year I'll be different. And you'll say, you're not the same guy you used to be. And then you may say, thank God. But you see, I never have to leave, and I can never do bad stuff that I'd have to leave you. And I always thought that what I did was I hung around as long as I could, and just before you told me to go, I'd pull out my stakes and go. See, I never belonged anywhere. I lived in a lot of places, but I never belonged there. And now I belong someplace. I live in a little house on a 10th green on a nice little golf course in a town called Fayetteville, North Carolina. Now, if you know anything about North Carolina, Fayetteville is not considered the greatest place in North Carolina. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine said if you were to give the state of North Carolina an enema, you'd insert the hose at Fayetteville. Now, I don't think that's true, but that's my home, and, you know, I belong there. And, you know, you'll find me there if I'm not a place like this. That's where you'll find me, you know, in a little house with a woman that I'm married to. And if you come by Monday nights at 8 o'clock, you'll find me at the new group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I make coffee there. And I make coffee there, and I sponsor guys. Sometimes I welcome people. But best of all, I make coffee. And there's some new upstarts who try to get there earlier than me to make the coffee. But I've been around too long. I beat them there. And they don't like my coffee. But I make it anyway. And I'm arriving about 6:30 now to make coffee for an 8 o'clock meeting. I got a sponsor named Tom, and I spend time with Tom. And we have a hard time getting together sometime. I'll be in Washington State next weekend, and Tom will be in Washington State, so we're gonna meet for lunch. But I got a man who loves me, Fawn loves me. He accepts me exactly the way I am. And my sponsor is the finest member of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever known. He's absolutely the finest member. And I sponsor a few guys. I sponsor more than a few guys. And these guys save my life. And I sponsor whoever asks me. And I do whatever I'm asked to do. I do it one day at a time. See, I always thought that I needed to find balance in my life. And balance in my life is God. And I'd like to say, before I close, something about God. You see, I was wrong about God. I thought God, all the things that... And you know, it's amazing. When I sat down and talked to my brother, Dumb Denny, I went up to make amends to Denny. I was sober about 5 or 6 years, and I drove up to where he was living, and we began to talk, and his wife, Jan, recognized that this was different. She excused herself, and she went off, and we began to talk. And I said to him, I said, you know, Den, I owe you an amends. I said, you know, you look so doggone good, and I felt so inadequate around you. I said, whenever I got a chance to say anything negative about you, I did. And I said, I've damaged you by detraction. And I said, and I stand ready to make amends in any way I can. I said, I've already tried to turn that around. And he started laughing, and he said, you know, if you owe me an amends, and I owe you an amends. He said, you know, my whole life, he said, I've been afraid. And he said, I was afraid to change my major. I was afraid to change schools. He said, I was afraid to change my marriage. And he said, I always watched you. And he said, you never gave a shit about anything. And he said, I always envied you. He said, if things weren't going well in one country, you'd go to another country. He said, you didn't care. And I discovered that Dumb Denny and I aren't good or bad. We're just different. That's all. We're different. We love one another so much. And you know, one day I went to talk to God. I just went to talk to him, you know. He was on my 8th and 9th step list, and I shared some stuff with him in my 5th step the way he said to it. But I wanted to talk to him, and I put on a 3-piece suit, and I went to a little chapel that I know, and I said, remember me, Father? I said, I'm the kid who used to serve Mass when nobody else wanted to do it. I'd be there 5:40. You could always count on me. You know, you had to, you know, plead a good case. So what I really ended up doing, though, was just talking to God, and I said, you know, I've been afraid, and I've wanted to stay away from you, and I've done things I'm ashamed of, and all the rest of it. And you know, when I left there, God and I had an understanding. And I recognized that day when I left that little chapel that God loves me so intensely. So intensely that it's unbelievable. Yeah. He sent his son for me. He did things for me that can't happen. He just loves me so very much. And you know what it reminded me of? My oldest daughter, Kelly. Yeah, she's a big girl now, a woman all grown and working and doing things. But I remember she was a little kid, and I took her to the playground. And you know how when little kids are, how they wander away from their parents, but they always look back, make sure you're there. Remember that? And every once in a while, they run back and touch you, and then they go out and play a little bit. And she got real brave, and she got clear over by the swings. And some bully came along and knocked her down, you know, and she got up, and she was disoriented, and she looked in the wrong direction and didn't see me, and she began to scream, Daddy, 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 Daddy. She was running in circles, and I was shouting to her, but she couldn't hear me because she was shouting, screaming so loud and everything. And all of a sudden, she stopped, and she saw me, and she ran over, and she threw herself in my lap, and she just sobbed. And she said, Daddy, I thought you were gone. And I said, Honey, I'll never go anywhere. She said, I thought you left. I looked for you. And I said, well, I was over here. I said, I was shouting to you, but you couldn't hear me because you were screaming and you were running in circles. And she said, I said, I'll never leave you, honey. And she said, okay. And she went off and played. And one day, that's what happened to me and God. I said to him, I said, you know, I said, I've been calling and screaming, and I've gone places that human beings shouldn't go, and I've done things that human beings shouldn't do. And he said, you know, I've always been there, but I was shouting to you, but you were running around and making so much noise you didn't hear me. He said, spend time with me and be quiet and hear me. And I said, will you always love me? He said, yeah, I'll always love you. It's okay. And then I go out and play. And from time to time, I go back and I crawl up into his lap and I let him tell me he loves me again. And then I go out and play. And I think that's what it's about. I think that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about for me. One day at a time, you're the miracle that caused all this to take place in my life. No one ever would have picked me to be sober with you. Most of all, I wouldn't have picked me. I moved to Fayetteville from Washington in 1980, and I was sitting on a balcony thanking God as I understood him. And I said to him, why me, Father? And I thought back to when I was in that treatment center and that woman I had tormented and abused. And after about 2 weeks and I knew that I was an alcoholic, I called her up. And I said, "I'm an alcoholic." She said, "No kidding." I said, "But why me?" She said, "Why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do it." She hung up. And I said to my father, I said, "Why me, Father?" And he said, "Why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do." And that's the miracle. God always wanted me to have this. He always did. Only I had a disease called alcoholism that didn't permit me to see him and you and to hear him and to hear you and all the love that's always been there for me. I truly love you. And that's not trite. I truly, truly love you from the very bottom of my heart and from the very basis of my being. Because that's precisely the way my father told me to do it. Thank you so much for having me. God bless you.